Good evening, and thank you for joining us for another New Moon Bible study. And tonight we are going to continue in the book of Hosea, and we will cover chapters 7 and 8 if you'd go ahead and open your Bibles. The last study we covered Hosea chapters 5 and 6, and we had heard more about God's judgment upon the house of Israel, and also a warning to the house of Judah because of consistent lawless and immoral behavior, which included widespread idolatry. And though the house of Israel is primarily mentioned in this book of Hosea, Judah was not far behind in her disobedience to God, and God was not vague in listing his reasons for being so disappointed with the nation of Israel. He gave, in fact, specifics of their wickedness. But along with mentioning the details, God also used illustrations and allegory or symbolism as a way to relate how wicked the tribes had become. And in this way, chapters 7 through 8 are similar to the previous chapters we have covered so far. And so God begins in chapter 7 by relating that it was not his desire to mortally wound the people. No, he would rather they had repented and turned from their ways so that he could comfort them and heal them. In verse 1 of chapter 7, when I would have healed Israel, he wished he could have healed Israel, but the iniquity of Ephraim was uncovered and the wickedness of Samaria, for they have committed fraud. A thief comes in, a band of robbers takes spoil outside. As shown throughout the history books of Judges and Kings, when the people turned away from God, they were oppressed by the surrounding Gentile tribes. The oppression was very hurtful to them, of course, and when they repented and they turned back to God and changed their ways, he would bind up their wounds and he would save them. And God would have liked to have healed them again and not allow any more injury to come. But a righteous God cannot allow evil to such a degree to continue and to go unpunished. When it says he would have rather healed Israel, but the iniquity of Ephraim was uncovered and the wickedness of Samaria. Now, Ephraim is specifically mentioned, but this may be referring to the northern nation as a whole, that is, the whole house of Israel, the northern kingdom, that did have capital cities that were found within the borders of the tribes or the tribe of Ephraim. But another capital region that contained a string of cities was that of Samaria, found within the borders of Manasseh. And there's no need for you to turn there, but I will mention that in 1 Kings chapter 13 and verse 32, it indicates that there were many shrines and high places of idolatry in the cities or the region of Samaria. And Isaiah chapter 7 and verse 9 relates that the head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is Remaliah's son. Now, Remaliah's son, who was went by the name of Pekah, was a king of Samaria and king of the house of Israel for 20 years. And he did much evil in the sight of God. And that is indicated in 1 Kings in chapter 15. Now, Ephraim falls under Samaria, which falls under Pekah, which points to wickedness throughout the northern kingdom at that time. As verse 1 of Hosea 7 states, for they have committed fraud, a thief comes in, a band of robbers take spoil outside. In other words, what is being related here is that they were wicked inside and out, and their fraud is directly related to their respective foreign gods, while continuing to claim that they were people of Israel, that is, having God's name. It is an Israel means he will rule as God. And so this is fraud, a masquerade, if you will. In verse 2 now, chapter 7, verse 2, it says, they do not consider in their hearts that I remember all their wickedness. Now their own deeds have surrounded them. They are before my face. So they are before God's face. God knows all. He can peer right into the heart of matters. He can see everything that is done in secret. He can even look into the heart of every individual. And so the things that Israel had done were not hidden from him. All of their evils, even if they were carried out on mountaintops or among groves, these high places of idol worship, their ill treatment of others, this was evil that was not concealed. God knew what they were doing. He knew every single sin of Israel, and they were stacking up to high heaven, so to speak, no pun intended. You see, it affected their whole environment. Their own deeds, it says, surrounding them are before God's face. And so it's a way of saying that God was viewing the nation on every side, from every angle, and their garments were spotted and stained all over the place, which necessitated a need for God to intervene, a complete destruction of the northern kingdom. In verse 3, they make a king glad with their wickedness and princes with their lies. So what this is relating is that national leaders were pleased with the evil because they saw it as financially beneficial. They saw it as pleasurable. You know, it's much like the corruption that we see in America's congressional government, who these people become millionaires with multi-million dollar homes while in office, and yet their federal salary alone could never gain them such affluence. It all comes from evil, and corruption is what it comes from. People wickedly flattered the king and princes with lies and favors, and it was the result of wicked deeds and resulted even in even more wickedness. Now verses 4 through 7 of chapter 7. They are all adulterers, like an oven heated by a baker. He ceases stirring the fire after kneading the dough until it is leavened. And in the day of our king, princes made him sick and flamed him with wine. He stretched out his hand with scoffers. They prepare their heart like an oven while they lie in wait. Their baker sleeps all night, and in the morning it burns like a flaming fire. They are all hot like an oven and have devoured their judges. All their kings have fallen. None among them calls upon me. Now, these verses that we had just read contain a lot of allegory, and it can be difficult to understand without close examination. So I will attempt an explanation by breaking the verses down and talking about each one individually. And so it begins by comparing the northern kingdom to an oven heated by a baker in verse 4. And so the people are the oven, and the heat is their passion for wickedness. Now the baker is a king representing, you know, various judges and or kings or, you know, people in positions of authority that would become corrupt. I think the Complete Jewish Bible translates these verses fairly well. And they translate verse 4 and 5 as they are all adulterers, like an oven heated by the baker, who doesn't stoke the fire from kneading time till the dough has risen. And on their king's special day, the leaders inflame him with wine, and he joins hands with scorners. And so the king is in derision with them. And the people treat righteous authority with contempt, and the king is given wine, and he becomes spiritually drunk and goes along with the desire to do evil. In fact, the first portion of this illustration shows that the king is the baker who actually started the fire, and the wicked rulers of the house of Israel, beginning with Jeroboam, and then the many other kings that followed this path. We have Elah and Omri and Ahab and Jehoram and Jehu and Jeroboam the second and Zechariah, and all of these persisted in walking in the sins of Jeroboam, who was the first king of the house of Israel, the northern kingdom. And then in the illustration, the wickedness intensifies like a fire growing in intensity overnight within the oven. And the Complete Jewish Bible translates verses 6 through 7, who ready themselves like an oven while they wait for their chance. And then the baker sleeps through the night, and then in the morning it bursts into flame. They are all hot as an oven, and they devour their judges, meaning they devour, you know, the good conscience of judges. And all their kings have fallen, that is, fallen from grace, that is, fallen from God's influence over their hearts and in their minds. And he said that not one of them calls out to me anymore. All of these kings and judges, none of them called out to God anymore. And so the wickedness of the people devour their leaders like an oven, influencing everyone. But the baker, that is the king, he was complacent. in this and even inspired it, starting it in the first place. Illustration shows that they all took part in kindling the flames of evil. And good judgment was tainted by the wine of false doctrine, and we are all familiar with that illustration, you know, drunk on the wine of the fornication of the harlot of Babylon. And the false doctrine of Babylon began during the time of Nimrod, and it has influenced people ever since that age. And so the house of Israel, they were vastly polluted, and all of their kings had fallen away from God's grace, that is, his influence over their judgment. And God indicated in the last sentence here, in verse 7, that there was not a single prince or king that would reach out to him. He said, none among them calls upon me any longer. And then we continue in verse 8. Ephraim has mixed himself among the peoples. Ephraim is a cake unturned. And so Ephraim seems to have been a tribe of particularly bad influence, a ringleader in this evil, if you will. And in this way, they joined hands with the heathen. And an example of this is found in Isaiah chapter 7 and verse 2, where it indicates that Syria had deployed forces within Ephraim's borders, and the tribe's heart was moved like the wind swaying a tree. And it means that Ephraim willingly went along with the Syrian invasion. And they, in this way, they sanctioned violence against their Israelite brothers, their own kin. And this is one of the ways that they mixed themselves among the heathen. Now, verse 8 states that they are like a cake unturned, meaning cooked on one side, but, you know, not all the way through, like a cake unfinished. And the expression denotes a tribe that never matured spiritually. They were infected and they learned the ways of the heathen. If you have a ribbon, put it here in Hosea in chapter 7 and turn back to Psalm 106. The book of Psalms in chapter 106. The mixture of heathen and Israelite tribes was not only taking place in the territory of Ephraim. And even though Ephraim is singled out at times, there can be no question that some of the references to Ephraim are reflective of the wider northern kingdom of Israel. Now consider a psalm believed to be written by Hezekiah sometime after the kingdom had divided into two, into northern and southern kingdoms. And in this psalm, the author mentions the willing integration of heathen among Israelite territories. And this is an example of how wicked the people had become. Psalm 106, and we will begin reading in verse 34. They did not destroy the peoples concerning whom the Eternal had commanded them, that is, eradicating the heathen from the land when they went into the land of Canaan or the Promised Land, but they mingled with the Gentiles and learned their works. They served their idols, which became a snare to them. They even sacrificed their sons and their daughters to demons, and they shed innocent blood, the blood of their sons and daughters, whom they sacrificed to the idols of Canaan, and the land was polluted with blood. Thus they were defiled by their own works, and played the harlot by their own deeds. Therefore the wrath of the Eternal was kindled against his people, so that he abhorred his own inheritance, and he gave them into the hand of the Gentiles, and to those who hated them they ruled over them. Their enemies also oppressed them, and they were brought into subjection under their hand. Many times God delivered them, but they rebelled in their counsel and were brought low because of their iniquity. Ephraim and Israel had mixed with heathen tribes by intermarriage, and they joined in their idolatry. Judah eventually did something likewise, and for this reason, if you go back to Hosea chapter 7, for this reason, it says in verse 9, aliens have devoured his strength, but he does not know it. Yes, gray hairs are here and there on him, yet he does not know it. And the pride of Israel testifies to his face, but they do not return to the Eternal their God, nor seek him for all of this. Foreigners had weakened the strength of Israel. The oppression caused the nation to lose much of its wealth and substance, and of course, their idolatry caused God to allow infiltration among their ranks. They became weak. Strongholds were not strong any longer. God was no longer with them. And verse 9 also states they do not know it. In other words, they refuse, I think. It's not that they didn't know. They refuse to recognize the fact that their weakness was a result of learning the ways of the heathen. And even though they were aware of loss through the oppression of foreigners, they were not sensible to recognize the real reason for their disadvantage. In other words, they refuse to recognize it. Pride. Too much pride. Sounds much like of America today, doesn't it? America is losing ground, and most do not realize it. They don't see that it's because we are forsaking the morality of God, you know, that once was the fabric of our society. And skewed as it may have been, you know, not true Sabbath keepers, but still people that were vastly decent and had morals that were biblically based for more than 150 years. But we don't see much of that any longer. People are proud of their immorality, just as Israel was proud of their evil. Verse 9 states that gray hairs are here and there on him, and he does not know it. So the house of Israel had grown weak, old, frail, as an elderly person might be, and their end was near, but the people refused to see it. Verse 10 says that the pride of Israel testifies to his face, but they do not return to the eternal their God, nor seek him. And this verse is likened to Hosea chapter 5 and verse 5, which states the pride of Israel testifies to his face. And so their proud polytheism and being proud of it was a testimony to the nation. The result was corruption, crime, a weak economy, a weak military. And this was a testimony to them. But they refused to see it, just as America and all nations today refuse to see the reason for their troubles. Now, verse 10 relates that the people were proud of their wickedness. They rejoiced in it, you know, and such pride was a witness as to why they would soon suffer destruction. But again, even though their evil was as plain as day, right before their eyes, they did not return to God. Just as our nation in America refuses to turn toward the good it once was. Our nation, along with Great Britain, Australia, New Zealand, and many others, we once understood the principles of the Bible, and we created laws based on what is right, what is ethically correct, according to the scriptures. But we have blatantly turned to evil, such as legalizing government bribery through lobbyism, by making the murder of unborn children legal, by allowing violent and pornographic movies and video games to flood the market and influence not just our youth, everyone. Yes, there has been a steady decline of Western civilization for a number of years now, and we all see it, but most people refuse to recognize what it truly is. You know, billboards in many cities contain images or words promoting lewd conduct. There are abortion clinics open for business in every city, but most refuse to acknowledge that evil for what it is. Many call the evil good and claim that we're a better nation today for turning away from the moral foundation that made this country great. People stand and cheer when abortion laws go into effect. Just like ancient Israel, such behavior will not go unseen by God. It is known by him. It will be remembered. And many are going to suffer the same fate as those people of ancient Israel. Verse 11 and 12 of chapter 7 in the book of Hosea. Ephraim also is like a silly dove, without sense. They call to Egypt. They go to Assyria. Wherever they go, I will spread my net on them. I will bring them down like birds of the air. I will chastise them according to what their congregation has heard. Ephraim is described as a silly dove. What this represents is something that is simple-minded, easily frightened by its surroundings, timid, if you will. They do foolish things. Israel was easily swayed by their foreign neighbors. And when they were oppressed, they seldom looked to God to deliver them. Instead, they would seek help from other nations. When oppressed by Assyria, they'd call out to Egypt for help. When Egypt threatened them, they would ask assistance from Assyria. Instead of repenting, changing their ways, and turning to God. And so their lack of good sense, it caused them to not realize that this was a snare of their own making. It was a trap to make alliances and commitments with ungodly foreign nations who didn't respect the true God. And so they set their own trap, and it was about to be sprung by God. As it says at the end of verse 12, I will chastise them according to what their congregation had heard. So the congregation being the people of Israel, the wider people, what they had heard is what God said to them through the prophets. He said this was coming. It was a warning to them. As Amos 3:7 says, God will do nothing unless he reveals it to his servants, the prophets, but not just to the prophets. He sends people out to warn the people, to warn the leaders. Turn from your wickedness. Turn back to God. Repent. But the vast majority would not believe the prophets. Just as the prophet Isaiah had said, who has believed our report? Very few. Very few believed and turned back to God. Verse 13. Woe to them, for they have fled from me. Destruction to them, because they have transgressed against me. Though I redeemed them, yet they have spoken lies against me. God redeemed the nation of Israel by bringing them out of the bondage in Egypt. When he did, God proved to them that all other deities worshipped by men were false, that he was the one and only true God, and he proved to both Israel and Egypt that he was the Most High. It says multiple times in the book of Exodus, while carrying out the plagues and the miracles, that this was done so that Israel and the Egyptians would know, I am the Eternal. And yet his people eventually spoke lies against the God of Israel, believing that he was not the only true God, that others could be worshipped and trusted, that he's not sovereign, nor are his ways true. And such lies led the entire nation to put their trust in wood or ceramics or metal, gods fashioned by the hands of men. That they would cry out to these idols when they were distressed. As God noted in verse 14, they did not cry out to me with their heart when they wailed upon their beds. Oh, they didn't. They cried out to these idols or to other nations to help them. This goes along with verse 11, which states that they are like a silly dove without heart. So their heart, their mind was in the wrong place. Their passion, their vision was corrupt. So they didn't cry out to the Eternal while lying in bed, stressed, afraid. They did not rejoice in God's laws and his feasts, but they found pleasures in the holidays of pagans, much like we see happening today. The second half of verse 14 says, they assemble together for grain and new wine, and they rebel against me. So assembling together for grain and new wine refers to pagan seasonal holidays that were revolved around times of harvest or new vintages of wine or the waxing and waning cycles of the sun. This was noted by the prophet Jeremiah in chapter 10 and verse 2, where God, through the prophet, said to Israel, do not learn the way of the Gentiles. Do not be dismayed at the signs of heaven. The Gentiles are dismayed at them or confused at them. And so they create these holidays around them, trying to bring the sun back by having bonfires and dancing around the bonfires. And that's what the signs of heaven refers to, a change in the seasons, which caused many to devise these false gods that they would worship. They held winter and spring fertility feasts, and they observed rituals in honor of the creation instead of the holy days in honor of the Creator. In verse 15, though I disciplined and strengthened their arms, yet they devise evil against me. Now, there are two forms of discipline referred to here that have something in common. One is punishment, and another is a form of instruction. Now, punishment can be instructive, while instruction can involve punishment. And both forms apply in verse 15, where God said that he disciplined and strengthened Israel. Being just and fair, God would discipline people through corrective punishment, and this can make people stronger. And so God corrected the wrong behavior when bringing Israel out of Egypt. He gave them to training them, to shape them into having the mental faculties of moral character. And this would make the nation strong, strengthen their arms. And their ability and stability to become strong would continue if they were firm in the eternal. But were they grateful for redemption and instruction in this way? Well, a few were, some were, but the vast majority were not. Instead, the imagination of their heart was frequently evil. They were mischievous. Instead of sincerely hearing God's prophets, they tried to do them harm. They killed many of the prophets. As Christ said, "Inasmuch as you did it to one of these, the least of my brethren, you've done it to me." So an assault on God's prophet is an attack on God. He takes it personally. This is how they would eventually repay God's goodwill toward them when he made them a great nation. In verse 16, they return, but not to the Most High. They are like a treacherous bow. Their princes shall fall by the sword for the cursings of their tongue, and this shall be their derision in the land of Egypt. Verse 16 has several points to make, so I'm going to break it up into four parts. And so the first part of verse 16 says that they return, but not to the Most High. And so they returned to worship, but they went back to the idol worship of Egypt, when the worship they came out of. Yes, their captivity in Egypt for several hundred years was a result of them sacrificing and worshiping these false gods of the Egyptians. False gods that their faithful fathers did not revere. Well, God eventually paid attention to their cries and their pain, their suffering while in Egypt, and he delivered them. He then re-instructed Israel in the wilderness, and for a time they were faithful, but they waxed and waned after going into the promised land. Ultimately, they did return, but not to the Most High. They returned to the debauchery that they were supposed to leave behind in Egypt. And that's why in verse 16 it says they are like a treacherous bow. In other words, a bow that is disloyal and misses the mark of the archer. And it reminds me of some of those cartoons where the character has a bow with a bent arrow and he shoots it and it flies around and then it strikes him in the rear end. I think this is much like what God is referring to, a treacherous bow. In other words, a bow that's going to do them harm. So at verse 16, it says, the princes shall fall by the sword for their cursings of their tongue. Cursings equals blasphemy or indignation. And we get the impression that the leaders were not only idol worshippers, but that they would curse the true God. Hatred of God, even. It developed to the point of making the eternal out to be reviled because they began to believe that God's laws were oppressive to them. He was raining on their parade, you know, removing their fun. Because his laws meant that they could not commit adultery, that they could not be homosexual, that they could not cheat others, that they needed to be honest and fair. It meant that they had to tithe. To give to God's ministers, support the temple, observe the days of rest that God commanded. And they began to see such ethics as restrictive. And this is exactly what we see happening in America today. It's not enough that people are forced to tolerate the and propagate the immoral ideal of liberals, but they curse the true God by attempting to paint a detestable image of his law. Because why? Because it condemns their behavior, their lifestyle. And for this reason, America and other nations who once respected the morals of the Bible will suffer a similar fate, just as the northern kingdom of Israel fell. Verse 16 continues to say, "This shall be their derision in the land of Egypt." 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles tell how Israel and Judah sought military assistance from Egypt, but Egypt turned on them. They plundered the Israelite cities on several occasions. In the turn of events are likely the derision spoken of that took place both in and from the land of Egypt. And so we are going to move forward and go right into chapter 8 and verse 1. It truly just continues, where it says, "Set the trumpet to your mouth. He shall come like an eagle against the house of the Eternal, because they have transgressed my covenant and rebelled against my law." Now, the trumpet being set to the mouth is referring to sounding an alarm. And when enemy forces would suddenly come upon Israel, they were to sound the trumpets, an alarm that war is on the horizon. And God is telling them, put your mouth on the trumpet. War will soon be at the door. "He shall come" is in italics in this verse, but rightly placed, I think, as to convey the meaning of an eagle swooping down on its prey. Like an eagle dives and grabs its victim by sinking deadly claws into the flesh, inflicting a fatal wound, so would the Assyrian forces swoop down, seize the nation in its clutches, and inflict fatal wounds. And the reason it was allowed was because they broke their covenant with God, as it says in verse 8. They transgressed my covenant, rebelled against my law even. In verse 2, Israel will cry to me, "My God, we know you." But Israel has rejected the good, and the enemy will pursue him. Kind of reminds me of the remorse felt by somebody who did wrong after they are caught and they have to suffer the consequences of their transgression. People are then sorry. And so Israel would cry out to God when war was at their door, when they were getting slaughtered. They'd cry out, "Why, God, why? We know you. You know us." But God's response would be, you were my people, but not any longer. As Jeremiah later said in Jeremiah 7 and verse 4, a similar example, he said, "Do not trust in these lying words, saying, 'The temple of the Eternal, the temple of the Eternal, the temple of the Eternal are these.'" In other words, just because the temple was within your borders, just because you were once known as God's people, just because you once kept the commandments and had a covenant with God, and just because you might still be aware that they exist, well, it counts for nothing if you do not keep the commandments. You can't ride on the coattails of the past, which is what we see America attempting to do today. We were once a great nation, as President Trump acknowledged, but not any longer. Sadly, making America great again will fail if we do not turn our values back to those of God. In verse 4, Hosea 8 and verse 4, "They set up kings, but not by me. They made princes, but I did not acknowledge them. So they took no counsel from God in setting up a new administration, and God did not approve of these leaders and the activities of those people that took charge." In verse 4, continuing, "From their silver and gold they made idols for themselves, that they might be cut off." Now this sounds as though Israel made idols of silver and gold with the intent that they would be cut off from God. Well, maybe so. Seems like they reviled him. But I think what this means, it's kind of like a self-inflicted wound. It wasn't done because they knew it would result in injury, but it was intentionally done so that they would separate themselves from the Eternal. And this left God with no choice. The blessings and cursings that their forefathers shouted from Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, this indicated what would become of Israel if they had abandoned divine ethics. And therefore, from silver and gold they made idols, and that would result in them being cut off from God. Verses 5 and 6. Your calf is rejected, O Samaria. My anger is aroused against them. How long until they attain to innocence? For from Israel is even this: a workman made it, and it is not God. But the calf of Samaria shall be broken to pieces. An example of the idols that separated them from God is a calf of Samaria that's mentioned here. Probably much like the golden calves Jeroboam had set up in Bethel and Dan. Samaria is another area that became a chief metropolis of the northern tribes, and it was a place of shrines and high places dedicated to various idols, and hence the reference to a calf being the reason Samaria is rejected. Now, calves were worshipfully used until the northern kingdom fell, but the expression, I think, here is symbolic of idolatry in general. God had asked in verse 5, how long until they attain innocence or purity? In other words, how long must he wait until they become holy? Till you clean yourselves, clean up your act. You know, God is patient, but he gave them hundreds of years to attain a level of purity. But in all this time, there were relatively few years of widespread righteousness. The majority of years were spent in spiritual adultery. This was not God's doing. As he stated, a workman made it. It's not from God. He didn't design this. He didn't intend for you to go down that path. Just as a workman fashioned the idols, their disloyalty was on their own hands, and it would be their own undoing. Verses 7 and 8. They sow the wind and reap the whirlwind. The stalk has no bud. It shall never produce meal. And if it should produce, aliens would swallow it up. Israel is swallowed up. Now they are among the Gentiles, like a vessel in which is no pleasure. Their undoing was Israel's own fault. They were zealous at times, but too often their passion was for sowing seeds of idolatry. It was like sowing seeds in the wind, whose stalk would not even produce any bud or fruit. Instead, it would cause them to eventually reap a hurricane. It says, now they are among the Gentiles, like a vessel in which is no pleasure. So their disloyalty and idolatry made them of no more value to God than the heathen tribes. And they are referred to as being among the Gentiles, that is, in rank, but they would literally be scattered among the Gentiles and swallowed up among the heathen nations, because they would lose their identity after being taken captive and scattered to the winds of history. In verse 9, for they have gone up to Assyria, like a wild donkey alone by itself, in other words, a stubborn mule going its own way, Ephraim has hired lovers, paying these heathen for idolatry, which is spiritual adultery. Verse 10, yes, though they have hired among the nations, now I will gather them, and they shall sorrow a little because of the burden of the king of princes. Now, the burden of the king of princes is talking about the exaction and the taxation of kings and princes, even of foreign nations. And this was a burden to them, but it would be just a little sorrow compared to what was coming. In verse 11, because Ephraim has made many altars for sin, They have become for him altars for sinning. I have written for him the great things of my law, but they were considered a strange thing. God makes laws that have good sense. They really do. In a world that often makes little sense, God is a breath of fresh air, a beacon of light. But Israel turned it around. You see, God gave them his law, but they turned from God's altar to building their own altars for sin. In the strange ways of the heathen, well, these seemed to make sense to them, and God's law was considered odd. And this is, again, happening in our country and in around the world today. The principles of God's law, they made sense to America at one point. Our founding fathers knew that they were right and good. And this democracy was built on biblical principles, but now people find them strange because our society is continuously erecting altars of sin. And those are what people want. Those seem familiar to them. Familiar spirits, if you will. Verse 13, "For the sacrifices of my offerings, they sacrifice flesh and eat it, but the Eternal does not accept them. Now he will remember their iniquity and punish their sins. They shall return to Egypt." And so the first part of this verse says that the sacrifices and offerings, they sacrifice flesh, they eat it, the Eternal doesn't accept them. The offerings that were supposed to go to God were used to serve a different purpose. And this may indicate polytheism, or the worshiping of calves, or Baal, or Ashtoreth, or what have you. But it also might indicate that they still recognized God, but they did not consider him sovereign, which may have led them to make occasional sacrifices to God, but not in the way that he prescribed, and not with the heart of understanding that he desires. Verse 13 says, "Now he will remember their iniquity and punish their sins, and they shall return to Egypt." And this did not mean that they would literally return to the nation of Egypt. What it means is they would return to a similar form of bondage that they experienced centuries prior in Egypt. Verse 14, "For Israel has forgotten his maker and has built temples. Judah also has multiplied fortified cities, but I will send fire upon his cities, and it shall devour his palaces," or citadels. Israel had forgotten who it was that made them a great nation. America has forgotten who it was that made this country a great nation. Judah also began to trust in their own thoughts that were opposed to God. They sought help from pagan nations. They attempted to defend themselves from destruction with a stubborn mind and by the strength of their own hands. But their efforts would not save them. And this is the message over and over again in the book of Hosea. Israel was a nation that made a covenant with God, but they played the harlot with false gods, and they broke the covenant time and time again. Now, God was merciful for a while. He was patient for centuries. But there comes a point when enough is enough. And such is the case with the world today. I say we are quickly approaching that time when God deems it enough. That is enough. Your sins have reached to high heaven. Another whirlwind is coming. And those Western nations that once knew biblical principles, that had them as guidelines for their statutes and laws, those nations are going to suffer immensely along with the heathen nations. It will be the time that's prophesied called the time of Jacob's trouble. But we can be saved from it. You see, we have the prophecies. We have been given an understanding of the Bible. We have been given God's law, and we have committed to it by making a covenant with him that we will follow you, God. We will keep your commandments. We have the history book here in the Bible as a schoolmaster to show us what will become of those people who forsake God. And this knowledge can allow us to be spared from the suffering that God will bring to this world when he brings the world to its knees before our King returns. And so let's use that knowledge wisely.